Welcome to the Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. The Reaction Podcast, where we discuss politics, geopolitics, economics, culture. And this week, I'm delighted I'm joined by Paul Goodman, editor of Conservative Home, former Conservative MP. And Paul, I think I'm right in saying we were both comment editors of The Telegraph at various times.
So welcome
to the podcast. Now, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, and I say that, don't usually put a sort of timestamp on it, just because things are moving very fast. We're going to talk today about Rishi Sunak's position. Is his leadership at risk? Will this new piece of legislation that he's unveiled to try and solve the Rwanda problem, will it work? But also very keen to get Paul's expert take on the longer term prospects for the Conservative Party. Paul, firstly, on this question of the legislation, is it as it stands at the moment, is what Sunak proposed in his press conference on Thursday morning, is that sufficient, do you think, to get something through that the Tory right, we'll come to that in a moment, what is the Tory right, what's it made up of, that can satisfy the Tory right, loose term, and the Tory left, and the sort of great bulk of the parliamentary party? Does it look as though it's going to work?
As you say, this is a moving story, and we're talking on the Thursday afternoon. By the time we go live, events may have moved on. But as we speak, this proposal of Rishi Sunak's is very delicately poised between elements of the Tory right, spearheaded by Suella Braverman and Robert Jenrick, who think it doesn't go far enough, and elements on the Tory left, who today were beginning to say to journalists that they suspect it may go too far. So the question, as you ask, is where does this all go? Well, first of all, we learn that Sunak is unlikely to try the double or quits game of making it a vote of confidence in the government. That's the position as it stands, although that may change. That would be less high risk, but would presumably open the way to more rebellion. Now, if you ask me to guess what's going to happen at this stage, my guess would be that this fabled star chamber of Bill Cash that rears its head every time the Conservatives are in serious difficulty. My guess is that they'll say, well, we don't entirely like this bill, but it gives us some of what we want, and we will let it go at second reading and come back with amendments. That's my best guess, but it may be, and who knows, given the current state of the Conservative Party, that because this bill is caught up in wider questions about Rishi Sunak's leadership, the Star Chamber comes back with a negative response and Rishi Sunak is then in very deep trouble.
It's a fascinating thing, that Star Chamber. And I've said several times on social media just how annoying I find the use of the term by the MPs involved. It's also, it must strike you as well, Paul, as it's an odd thing for a group of Conservative parliamentarians who believe in the rights of Parliament to use as a name, because of course the Star Chamber wasn't invented by Charles I, but it was ended effectively by Charles I's conduct. It's a symbol of arbitrary government, personal rule, and helped contribute to the to the outbreak of the Civil War. I mean,
I'd love to know who invented the term and whether or not they were thinking less of that than as the Star Chambers I remember from my early political youth that were summoned in the Thatcher days with William Whitelaw chairing them in order to adjudicate questions about public spending. Right. So if a spending minister was being really difficult, he would be hauled in front of Willie Whitelaw, then the Deputy Prime Minister, and a fairly sort of fearsome character in his way, and have to justify himself. But that's an aside.
Yeah, could be that, or I think there is a film called Star Chamber, starring Michael Douglas. It might be that, but if it's a, you know, it's in Parliament. These meetings are held in Parliament. It's the term Star Chamber in parliamentary history is not a compliment. But anyway, that's by the by. But that's a way of me asking: really, is the Conservative Party with the existence of the Star Chamber, various groupings, the groups on the left as well, the various leadership contenders, is the party in Parliament governable at the moment, do you think? Whether Rishi Sunak is the leader or anyone else?
At times during this Parliament, and indeed over the last 6 or 7 years, the answer has seemed to be no. Rishi Sunak, whatever else you may think of his premiership, did appear to bring a certain stability at first back to the parliamentary party. So then the answer swung back to being yes. But the Conservatives do, roughly, you know, every 70 years or so, get themselves into this position about a matter that's fundamental and constitutional, as well as economics. So there's free trade in the 19th century, then another burst of free trade in the early part of the 20th. And then this great European-related question that's run on in various forms. And we will find out in the next week. For me, I have difficulty looking at this pullulating mass of right-wing groups that I'm, you know, paid to know, from knowing what the difference is between the common sense groups, say, and the new conservatives, some of whom are actually very old conservatives indeed.
That's a very good way of putting it. What is the essence of the dispute? I mean, obviously, there's an argument about Rwanda, which, isn't it fascinating the way in politics these things become almost a totem, this idea that it's the policy on which you measure your commitment to a certain kind of conservatism. And it's actually really, I mean, I'm a skeptic on the policy. It's a Boris Johnson-era wheeze, which was designed to try and do something on boats, on, you know, in terms of stopping the boats, but it's not some element of the constitution, or am I wrong? Is it actually a reflection of a really deep split in the conservative movement in the UK on international law, international institutions, sovereignty? Perhaps some Brexiteers discovering that you can declare parliamentary sovereignty, but it has its limits within international law and the various sort of web of entitlements and obligations which governments down decades have signed up to. So in a sense, it's a fight between two different views of the world.
Yes, at one level, it is, as you correctly say, a Boris Johnson-era policy, which ought to be remembered when the blame or the praise for this is being heaped on the head of Rishi Sunak. But at another level, it is about something more fundamental. And it's partly about where political authority comes from. And you're very familiar with this in the context of Brexit, which I think we both supported. This is another aspect of it, really, about whether law is adjudicated ultimately here or abroad. However, there's another dimension to it that's really fascinating, which is whether or not political authority ultimately lies with those we elect or with the courts. Now, I think it would be very unfair to accuse the Supreme Court in the recent Rwanda judgment of playing politics. I think the court in this case did what it did with the legislation it had got.
Absolutely.
But you only have to go on Twitter or X or whatever it's called now to see well-qualified academics arguing ultimately that politicians do not have the right to make law and that they should be and are constrained by rights that are more fundamental than they are. And you know as an amateur historian that we fought a civil war over this issue, 400 or so years ago, and it's uncomfortable to see it being raised now.
Just on Sunak's personal position, then, is And again, this might be out of date within sort of 24, 48 hours. How exposed is he personally? It felt on Wednesday, as this was all sort of developing, it felt as though he might face a challenge. As you say, he's not making the vote a vote of confidence in his administration, but nonetheless, all the chatter was swirling again about MPs who were going to put in their letters. I assume 20 or 30 already have, who are irreconcilable. Does it look as though it's coming to some kind of leadership challenge even before Christmas?
So if you'd have asked me a week ago, I would have said the prospect was remote. I would have actually been surprised if you'd raised the question. But it's been bubbling away this week before we saw the Rwanda legislation. And I started to become aware of all this chatter about letters really at the start of the week. And what I think is happening here is not that the Rwanda policy, you know, failings or successes of which have sparked the letters, but you've got to see Sunak's political position as a whole. If you look at Politico's poll of polls, the Conservatives are about 19 points behind. They had their conference, that didn't give them a lift. They had a reshuffle, that didn't give them a lift. They had the autumn statement with some modest tax cuts, that didn't give them a lift. They are running out of springboards on which to relaunch themselves. They've really, formally, really only got the budget left as a big set piece before the election. And Conservative MPs are, in some cases, beginning to panic. And you throw into the mix the state of the economy, the legacy of COVID, the continuing horrible war waged by Putin in Ukraine, the crisis for living standards, the government's about turn on immigration, really caused by the oddity of having three successive Conservative leaders who are fairly liberal on migration and really at odds with what party members, MPs and many Conservative voters want. You throw all that into the mix, and the factionalists for the last few years, and the legacy of Brexit, and it's quite a dangerous moment for Rishi Sunak. And I know quite senior Conservative MPs are now convinced there will be a challenge.
But if there is a challenge, one has to assume that he would win a confidence vote among Tory MPs relatively comfortably?
I think it's very difficult to say. But the logic of the situation really is this. Let's suppose they voted out Rishi Sunak. OK, so you're going to have another leadership election. You're going to put in the third leader since Boris Johnson was led the Conservatives to victory in 2019. At this point, I think the moral pressure for a general election becomes considerable.
Agreed.
Now, you might argue that the Conservatives can put in as many leaders as they like because they've got a majority. But I think we found in the autumn of 2019 that if there's a mood around for an election, it has a way of happening. And in the balkanised present condition of the Conservative Party, were Sunak to be driven out, were another leader to come in, that leader would surely find themselves at odds with the Sunak people, probably with the Truss people, insofar as there are any, the Boris Johnson people. There are MPs who are retiring who might not have a stake in maintaining a Conservative government under another leader. I mean, in these conditions, I think it would be perfectly credible to see the Conservative poll rating going down even further. And the voters, you know, simply saying in the immortal words of Kylie Minogue, you know, what kind of fool do you take me for? Don't want to see your face no more.
Yeah, I can see that. But it, because of course, if they do replace him, then, and it's incredible that we're even talking in those terms. As you say, it didn't seem feasible just a few weeks ago. But they're not then constitutionally not obliged to hold a general election. But as you say, yeah. I suppose it's another example of what Truss discovered, that you can say what you like, but politics is ultimately is contingent on reality. And just the reality is that the country would be so appalled by the spectacle of another leadership election. As you say, that so that would be the fourth prime minister this parliament, that it would just become impossible to resist, and essentially the government would collapse in on itself and you would end up with an election early next year. But then there are some conservatives out there, some people I know who'll be listening to this this podcast, because I've been talking in other places with them about it, who think, look, and I think this view is mistaken, very gravely mistaken, but their view is the Tories are 20 points behind in the polls. Sunak has failed to establish himself for whatever reason. Maybe we'll talk about why that is in a moment, what seems to have gone wrong. Why not roll the dice, put in place, I assume it would be Kemi Badenoch or James Cleverly, put someone else in place and go to the country on a clear statement of values and hope for the best. I mean, that to me sounds like the fastest route to a Labour majority of 200 plus.
Suppose you're on a raft and you're heading towards the edge of the cliff. This massive waterfall is going to take you down. The hardest thing to accept, I imagine, is that you're going over the edge. And you think that you must do something, capital D, capital S, do anything in order to stop it happening. But the most likely consequence of trying is just that the raft is going to split up quicker and more people are going to drown. That's my take. There are some people who argue that some knight of Gotham is going to arrive and somehow rescue the Conservatives from the situation where Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss and Boris Johnson could not. And I think that, you know, truly is you would require a political genius to do this. And I don't think you've got that kind of political genius around.
Why has it happened, do you think? I mean, the theory was that I wrote, and I think you did, but you had this view as well, Paul, earlier in the year, that Sunak had restored some order. I personally didn't necessarily agree with every particular policy, but you could see that the business was being conducted in a stately, dignified way in comparison to the madness of what had happened the previous autumn and the later period of Boris Johnson. So the theory was that the Tories would get a reward for that, a reward from the electorate for a return to normality. And there were some signs in January, February, March of a slight uptick, which Number 10 were quite excited about at the time. Since then, the opposite has happened. The polling situation has got worse. What's the root of that? Is it just 13 years in power, too many prime ministers, too many mistakes, can't expect the public, after having put on the show of the last 5 or 6 years, to then say, ah, well, this lot deserve another go, so it's just too far gone? Or is there something else at play here? Is it down to mistakes that Rishi Sunak himself has made in strategic terms?
Well, first of all, the fundamentals are bad, and we've discussed that, and there's no reason to go over them again. Second, the task that Sunak faced was very hard for this reason, that the Conservatives have done very well out of reinventing themselves. So when David Cameron failed to win the referendum and resigned, the Conservatives were able to say, we've got this marvellous new woman called Theresa May who wants to address burning injustices. And at first, the voters seemed to quite like it. And then she couldn't get Brexit through, and the Conservatives were able to say, don't you worry, we have this marvellous new person who's not at all like Theresa May, called Boris Johnson. He will get Brexit done. And so the Conservatives were able to then reinvent themselves for a second time. And after a while, you just sort of can't keep doing this unless you are a master magician of a politician. And that brings us to Sunak himself. And I think Rishi Sunak's lesson in life has been and sort of reflected in his whole life story and what he's achieved, is if you get up early in the morning, wash behind your ears, say your prayers, pat the dog, stick by your family, work hard, get out and master all the spreadsheets, there's nothing you can't achieve. Unfortunately, a big element of politics is presentation and sort of braggadocio. And he's been unable to convince people that he represents change from the Johnson and Truss era. And so gradually he sort of seems to me to have fallen back on trying to be a competent chief executive, struggling with all these great issues. And it hasn't moved the voters to give the Conservatives a third or fourth chance.
I mean, I must admit, as I said, I disagree with some of the decisions which have been made. I actually really rather find the change rather refreshing after the Truss era. I do think potentially, though, talking to someone who was a big promoter of Sunak recently, now a little disillusioned, who put it to me in the following terms, which is that Sunak failed to make to choose, essentially failed to make a clear choice about what kind of prime minister and what sort of administration he wanted to lead, by which I suppose he meant he's tried to keep the right on board, could have actually just said right at the start, listen, trying to make Rwanda work. But it's clearly implausible as far as the courts and international law are concerned. Britain is not going to leave the ECHR because it just isn't, and there isn't the sort of political bandwidth for it, and it would be far too complicated and leave Britain out on a limb internationally. But rather than choosing, he tried to keep the right on side and the left on side, obviously trying to run a sort of broad coalition. And then there was something really mistaken, I think, in the party conference approach. That attempt to present himself as a manifestation or an example of change, being the change maker, the break with 30, the failed status quo of the last 30 years, as he put it, landed him in a very odd position because it's clearly implausible. If you walk into a pub, most people are not paying that much attention to politics, of course, but if you ask people about it, it just doesn't, it's just not plausible, the idea that he represents some extraordinary break with the story of the last 13 years and is a fresh start. You don't need to vote for Keir Starmer because this guy is already sufficient change. He was Chancellor under Boris Johnson. He is a member of the Tory establishment, you know, promoted by the Tory establishment. So it was inherently implausible. It also then denied him the chance to actually make the case for some of what has happened in the last 13 years. I mean, it's a question you get asked a lot. People say, well, how are the Tories going to, do they have anything to point to after the last 13 years? And actually, from Tory MPs, you get kind of blank stares and they're miserable and depressed about it. But then you look at the PISA education scores this week on schools in England. And it's a fantastic story. Of course, it has its origins pre last 13 years. It goes back through New Labour as well, New Labour's education reforms, which then have their roots in what Ken Baker and John Major did in the 1980s and then the 1990s. So it's a long story of committed British or English reform because it hasn't happened in Scotland and Wales. And it is people. It runs counter to the fashionable narrative that everything is terrible in the country. But there you have an example, the last 13 years on, for example, phonics and the work that Nick Gibb has done in schools. And the number, the gradings have gone in the right direction. Now, if you say everything about the last 13 years and indeed the last 30 years is a complete failure, then you can't, on the other hand, turn around and say, well, actually, look at schooling, because there is a lot of improvement, and don't believe the sort of endless talking the country down stuff, which is something that clearly frustrates Sunak. But do you see what I mean, Paul? Going for the trying to make himself the change candidate means he can't actually talk convincingly about some of the positive stuff which has happened.
the dark side of the successful conservative reinventions, Cameron to May, May to Johnson, was that they deliberately turned their back on the coalition, which in retrospect looks like quite a sturdy period of government.
Mm.
And the oddity, of course, is now with David Cameron coming back, they must have someone who, when asked about the coalition, will remember what happened and defend it.
Yes.
Now, as for Sunak and change, I think that Downing Street looked rationally at the road ahead in the summer and said, well, we can fight one of two sorts of campaigns. We can fight a better the devil you know campaign or a it's time for change campaign. And really, general elections usually boil down to one of those two. Chuck the rascals out or better the devil you know. And I think they looked around and said, well, there's precious little that voters will feel they can hang on to if you say, you know, better the devil you know, hang on to what you've got, because there's not very much to hang on to at the moment with the collapse in living standards and all that. So we must try to present ourselves as change. And I think they did, but, you know, discovered in the course of trying to do this that, as you say, Rishi Sunak's personality, his approach, his temperament just didn't work.
But as Chris Dillow, on be familiar to some people on from his writing and from Twitter, who I think it's fair to say is, well, he's a very clearly left-wing commentator, very good, very interesting commentator. As he put it, isn't it just weird that you've got low unemployment? To have low unemployment and improvements in school standards, really quite dramatic improvements in school standards in England in the last 13 years. And the government doesn't really, I know there will be individual ministers who will presumably get in touch and say, no, of course, they've issued press releases on this subject, but it's not part of the, but no one really reads those press releases. It's not part of the government's story. Now, employment plus schooling, they're two pretty big things in the life of the nation. And then if you take on the cost of living and wages, actually the signs are, so inflation's come down sharply, not down to the government necessarily. Of course, it's down to changing international conditions plus what the bank has been doing. But there are positive signs as well in parts of the economy on wages as well. So you could, it's feasible to imagine a scenario in 6 months' time where in certain strands of the electorate, things are starting to feel a bit better. And if you have a couple of things like schooling and low unemployment to point to, then you've got the makings of a more positive story, which they don't seem anxious to tell.
But by that logic, the Conservatives should have done much better in 1997, when the economy True. Was booming merrily away. But the voters had just had enough.
Yep.
And that, I think, is the problem now, that you may go into the election with wages running ahead of inflation. That traditionally is very good for governments. But you have to have fundamental confidence in the ability of the government that is making the offer to you. And that's been stretched very thinly. Your living standard may be rising now, but you've been through a heck of a difficult time in the last 2 years. And then the opposition may not have, and it doesn't have, the razzmatazz of Blair in the mid-1990s. But Starmer, in his methodical, dull but efficient way, is closing down every possible obstacle to losing. And goodness knows what he's going to do if, or as is more likely, when he wins. And he arrives with no money, but they've closed down just about every avenue the Tories have explored so far.
I think Labour, listeners to this podcast will be familiar with my view, may turn out to be wrong, but I think there's a pretty good chance if you get a Labour government that it gets lucky. I know commentators like Simon Nixon disagree with me and think that the economic situation could get a lot worse, actually, in the next couple of years, make things very difficult for a new government. he may be right, but there's a scenario in which actually new government globally economically would do a little bit of luck. You start to get a surge in investment, which is likely, considering the work that Jeremy Hunt has done as Chancellor. You look at the stuff that's happening there and pro-growth, supply-side reform. And you just need a little bit more luck on the economy and a little bit more room for manoeuvre. And then Labour, I'm pretty much certain, will go on a building spree, which, of course, is pro-growth. That gives things a kick as well. Which that, I suppose, is a nightmare scenario for the Conservatives, is that they lose badly and then Labour gets the luck, as Labour did in 1997, of course, as you pointed out, Paul, that the inheritance in 97 economically was very positive. Which leads me on to the question, what happens to, and not writing Rishi Sunak off completely, or the Conservatives, still a year or so to go, maybe less, maybe a little bit more. But what happens to the Conservative Party if the defeat is as bad as it appears to be? It appears as though it's going to be a defeat with a Labour majority of somewhere between 100 and maybe even 200 if reform put on a strong showing as well. It could be very bad indeed. What happens to the Conservative Party afterwards, do you think, Paul?
Well, the worse the result is for the Conservatives, the worse their internal agony is likely to be. And I think that you have to imagine what happens in the following way, that when someone dies, there's apparently this classic cycle one goes through, from denial to anger to bargaining to acceptance, is the classic model. Mm-hmm. And I think the anger phase will last for quite a while, because the Sunak people will blame the Truss people and the Johnson people. The Truss people will blame the Sunak people. The Johnson people will blame everyone else and argue that he should come back and restore to the Conservatives that sense of ebullience and confidence that we associate with Boris Johnson, conveniently forgetting what happened to his government and why he fell in the first place. So there'll be all that. And whoever the new leader is will have to deal with all these factions and the politicians who've lost their seats writing their memoirs and all the score settling, and very much like the period after 97. And that, after all, sent the Conservatives into three periods of opposition. Mm. And this would have the potential to do the same.
Do you think there is a danger that the Conservatives go off in an almost Trumpian direction? For some reason, I'm thinking of Nadine Dorris's book, The Plot, and all of that, and the shenanigans of the Star Chamber, and all of this, these internal groupings, which, as you say, Paul, if we've followed this stuff for years, and if we're confused about who these groups are and what they want and what they believe in, other than hating some of their colleagues for reasons that are lost to history that no one can really remember. If that's the case for us, I mean, it's just bewildering for the general listener or viewer. And in those circumstances, if they are sitting there with a Labour majority of 150, and quite a lot of the party's best talent then presumably would be out of Parliament, people would have lost their seats, there's a danger of it going quite Trumpian, quite populist, isn't it? Isn't there?
I think sometimes the prism through which all this describes isn't very helpful. There's this talk of moving to the right or moving to the left or whatever. Actually, there's a lot of support for some right-wing positions, in the immigration position, for example. I think what really counts is what you're trying to do. Are you trying to make a broad appeal to a mass of voters, or are you essentially talking to yourselves? Now, this might sound quite an odd thing for an editor of a specialist website like Conservative Home to say, because after all, we're largely writing for party members and people in the Westminster village and people who follow what's going on in politics. But I think that the danger for the Conservatives after the election, if they don't win, as was the case for Labour during the last 13 years, is are you talking to the voters or are you talking to yourselves? And there is now a whole, and I hope and think we're not part of it, you and I, a whole what one commentator has called a right-wing entertainment complex that largely exists to sort of boost its own ratings. You know, you see this in America. And, you know, you referred to a recent book by a recently departed cabinet minister who's a very well-known novelist, right? Fiction is not the mirror. It's not the lens through which one should see politics. And my worry is that you know, the Conservatives will go off into this world where they simply talk to themselves about their own preoccupations with their feuds, with their grievances and memories, and scratch and scrabble at each other for a very long time until the electorate, until they're ready, really, to face the electorate again.
Yeah, that they have to try and rediscover that these things must be reality-based. Is there a more optimistic view for them, do you think? Is there a scenario in which Labour government doesn't get that lucky break economically that I referred to that might be coming?
There's always a scenario because you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, 5 years ago, one wouldn't necessarily have predicted the, you know, Putin invasion of Western Ukraine. You wouldn't necessarily have thought that Hamas, rather than coming to some, you know, sort of accommodation with Israel, whereby they don't recognise it, but at least live alongside it. I mean, there's no way of most people realising that Hamas were set on the course that their original charter set them on. So, you know, anything can happen.
But just look at the Labour Party. That's the perfect comparison, because 4 years ago, if you'd said that the Labour Party in late 2023 would be 20 points ahead in the polls, that Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson would be back advising the leadership, that the leadership was picking a centrist, social democratic, taking a social democratic course, and that people like Douglas Alexander were back being selected as candidates, that and the party stood on the verge of power with Pat McFadden, in a sense, you know, preparing a programme for government, and that things would be as disciplined as they are. I know they've had some rebellions recently on the issue that you mentioned, Paul. That would have seemed implausible 4 years ago. So it's not inconceivable that the Conservative Party, with the Labour, if the Labour Party gets into difficulties in government, could rebuild itself in a similar way.
It takes time if the defeat is very big. I mean, certainly, I suspect that when the average Labour member voted to put Keir Starmer in a situation in which Boris Johnson had been returned with a majority of 80, I suspect, you know, what do I know about Labour members, but that a lot of them thought, well, we're going to be out for a bit. We've been through this scarring Corbyn experience. What we need is someone who is essentially sort of competent, but of the left, a kind of equivalent to a Neil Kinnock figure, who will steer us through some difficult times. And Starmer's jaw must have dropped with amazement in the last few years as he's seen the Conservatives give him gift after gift after gift.
Yeah. Yeah. Does the Conservative Party, in its membership structures and in its just the architecture of the Conservative Party, you know it very well, Paul, having been an MP, Conservative Home is, it has its finger on the pulse in terms of what the membership and the activists are thinking. Where are they, do you think? Are they liable to go off in a sort of populist direction, or is there still a solid centre of common sense Conservatives who see what you described very well earlier on, the need to talk to the country as well as the party. I mean, I do know Conservative members who say, well, if Suella Braverman was the next leader of the Conservative Party, they would be off. They don't want to be in that kind of Conservative Party. But actually, people should probably stay for and vote, shouldn't they? If they are members of the Conservative Party, then that's they almost have an obligation to try and pick a sensible leader of the opposition.
Well, our contact with members in a meaningful representative sense comes through the monthly Conholme survey, which has quite a decent record over a long period of time. And my reflection looking at it as the editor of Conholme over time has been it kind of basically divides between two-thirds of people who are right of party centre and about a third who are roughly left of party centre. And that tends to be roughly what leadership elections provide. Mm. You know, Boris Johnson won roughly 2-1. Liz Truss won by a less big margin. But in the leadership elections that have gone to the members, so that's every single one since Ian Duncan Smith was elected, the more right of centre candidate has won each time, bar one. And that was David Cameron in 2005. But by that time, the Conservatives had been through this cycle of losing in 97 and in 2001 and in 2005. And they were then tired of losing and looking for someone who was a winner. I don't think they're in that state of mind at the moment. So roughly speaking, I would expect if two candidates are put before them by the MPs, and one is more right-wing than another, then the more right-wing of those two candidates is likely to win. This immediately sets up a problem, which is what happens if the MPs vote for one candidate, but the members return another. This is not a recipe for stability. Ian Duncan Smith couldn't survive it. Neither did Liz Truss. And when you get in that situation, it becomes very difficult for the Conservative Party to sustain it.
Final question. Very difficult to know. Things moving very fast. But you've given us a great insight into it, Paul. Do you think, on balance of probability, do you think that Rishi Sunak will be the Conservative Party leader who takes the Tories into the next general election?
On balance, yes, but I think it's quite tight. Events have a way, because they contain their own momentum, of springing surprises.
Paul Goodman, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to the Reaction podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, you go to our website, www.reaction.life, and become a subscriber, and you get my weekly newsletter on politics, geopolitics, culture, economics, and all the other work from our brilliant team on Reaction. Until next time, thank you very much for listening.